You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 2 given in Bern on the 28th of June, 1921. Today we shall take as our starting point what I suggested when I spoke to you here last time. There is a question which arises for people today as a kind of riddle of our time, and which is at the same time a deep riddle for the whole of humanity, namely, how do the phenomena of nature, to which we are subject as physical human beings, relate to those of the moral or ethical world, which we somehow have to acknowledge if we wish to retain our human dignity? People can be as materialistic as they like in respect of science, but if they have even the faintest notion of their human dignity, they will acknowledge the difference between good and evil, morality and immorality. However materialistic they are, they will nevertheless somehow look up, however reluctantly, perhaps with questions, with doubts, to a kind of spiritual world, a spiritual world order which pervades the natural world, and to which we belong with our physical sense-oriented bodies. But when we look at what comes toward us from contemporary culture as guidance on the nature of the world, our human thinking, human feeling, and all our human impulses are faced with a dichotomy which cannot easily be resolved. On the one hand, we have the results of natural scientific research, which has proved so impressively successful, and which, from observation of outer phenomena, can rightly or wrongly go on to make hypothetical statements about the beginning and the end of the world. And on the other, we have the challenges of the ethical, moral world. But how is one to resolve this dichotomy when one hears on the basis of quite consequent natural scientific considerations, there was once a kind of world nebula. From this our world took shape, initially as a kind of mineral wave form. Then, gradually, the world of plants emerged, followed by the animals. The human being appeared last of all. Then, if we extend this way of thinking, this same system of laws, to the evolution of the earth itself, we will conclude that in time this earth will return to being a kind of mineral nebula, and will no longer be the stage on which to live out our lives, will no longer sustain living beings, and will, in other words, become a big cemetery in which lies buried everything that was once alive, ensouled, and home to the spirit. So, we stand midway between one mineral world and another, are fashioned out of this mineral world, with all our organs, which are in fact just structures in which the materials which constitute the outer world appear in a more complicated form. And now the human being who has emerged in this way, from the hypothetical world posited by natural science, faces the challenge to be moral, to be good. Ideas and ideals will be held, and the question will arise, what will happen to these requirements of a moral world, these ideals and ideas, when one day all that we can grasp with our natural science, including the human being, will fall into decay in that great final cemetery? Of course, one can argue that this is taking the natural scientific way of thinking to its hypothetical extreme, and one is not obliged to do so. But then at least the question should arise, where then are we to turn? Where can we obtain any clarity about the position of the human being in the universe as a moral being, a being that can have ideas and ideals? These questions have to be faced unless we simply leave it to natural science to develop hypotheses about the beginning and the end of the world. However, from all that can be offered by currently accepted scientific sources, based largely on the achievements of natural science, nothing can be determined about the role of the human being in the universe. I'd like to explain what we experience as a dichotomy at present, one which is closely connected with all the forces of decline, which are so terribly evident in our time, by asking you to imagine one of our contemporaries. This person will have absorbed all that counts as enlightenment, education, and scientific knowledge today. In other words, someone who feels really well educated. This person will be compared to one from a Greek cultural background, someone who lived in pre-Socratic times, roughly in the era of which we know so little today, apart from a few sayings of the great philosophers Heraclitus, Anaxagoras, and so on. I would like to juxtapose a Greek from that period with an intelligent person of today. By this I don't mean a Greek in his current incarnation, who would, after all, if he were in a human body, be a very clever contemporary of ours, but rather a Greek as he would have been in that bygone era. So someone in their incarnation as a Greek is what I would like to juxtapose with a clever person of our own time. Such a person from ancient Greece would say, quote, "Well, you modern people no longer know anything about the human being because you basically don't know anything about the world either." Close quote. Quote, "What do you mean?" Close quote, the intelligent modern person would say. He would add, quote, "We have identified roughly 70 elements. There are now 118, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, and so on. Moreover, we have now reached the point where it seems that all these elements can be traced back to one source, but we have not yet quite got there. These 72 elements which combine with each other and separate, we recognize as what is basically responsible for everything that goes on in the physical world." Close quote. Then the Greek would reply, "It's all very well that you now have so many elements, but this will in no way enable you to come to an understanding of what the human being is. There is no question about that, because the beginning of all understanding," the Greek would say, "relies not on the 72 or 76 elements you might mention, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, etc., but rather on the idea that everything that belongs to the outer world of the senses is composed of earth, water, air, and fire." Close quote. Our clever contemporary would say, quote, "Yes, that used to be the case in the childlike times when people did not know as much as we do today. They would talk about earth, water, air, and fire, but we have progressed far beyond those childlike views. People then assumed there were only four elements, but now we know there are 76 elements. That was a childlike way of looking at the world. We know that H2O is not an element. We also know that air cannot be referred to as an element. We know that warmth or fire is not an element at all. We are immensely knowledgeable. You simply had a childish view of the world." Close quote. Now, the Greek might reply, quote, "I have given some thought to your 70-odd elements and the way in which you look at them. What matters is how you look at things, and these roughly 70 elements all belong, according to our way of thinking, to earth, but not in any way to water, air, or fire, simply to earth. It was very good that you were able to distinguish and to differentiate and specify the components of the earth into 72 or 76 different elements. Absolutely fine. We had not yet identified all these interesting details, but grouped them all together under the concept earth. On the other hand, you have absolutely no idea of what we mean by water, air, and fire, and for that very reason can have no understanding of what the human being is." Close quote. You see, the Greek of that era would say, quote, "There are two kinds of human beings, on the one hand the kind that wanders the earth between birth and death, as a child at first, then as an adult, and on the other there is the human being who is laid out as a corpse for a few days and subsequently buried. We are only speaking of the physical human being, close quote. The Greek would say, quote, and thus, there is only this twofold figure, the person who wanders about between birth and death, and the one who lies in the grave. What you have come to know with your 72 or 76 elements that combine and separate refers only to the human corpse lying in the grave. Your chemistry and physics can tell us about what is to be found in the corpse, but can tell us nothing of the living person who wanders the earth between birth and death. You have a science that focuses only on observing the dead human being. You understand nothing of the live human being. You have been quite happy to develop your science into a science of the dead human being, but with no concern for the living one. If, however, you want a science of the living human being, you will first have to turn your attention to the comprehensive, universal living and weaving of what we call water. Moreover, we don't only refer to water as the crude, fluid element that flows in the brook, but what we call water contains everything in the world that flows together and is cold and fluid. Close quote. That is what the Greek would say. And the moment we wish to develop a living concept of what flows together as coldness and wetness and all its forms, we face the necessity of thinking in pictures rather than in mere concepts, mere ideas, abstractions. The Greek would go on to say, quote, if one can perceive moisture, together with any sensation of cold, when that in turn blends with another form of moisture shaped by the watery element, or manifesting in another sensation of cold, then one can have weaving, living images in moisture and coldness. One can then begin to achieve an understanding of the nature of plants and see the weaving together of moisture and coldness in such a way that it is not merely crude material water, but rather the interweaving of moisture and cold. The plant world manifests in images as it tears itself away from the ground. By means of the moisture within it, it tears itself away from the cold, for the earth is dry and cold. In the way in which the plant world takes shape through spring, summer, and autumn, one can see different aspects of the weaving of the watery element, and all at once the mighty imagination of this outer weaving and living of wateriness grows within us. Contained within it is the entire plant world in all its forms. Close quote. The Greek would go on to say, quote, what matters to us is not what belongs to the senses, but rather the supersensible interweaving of coldness and moisture. That is what matters to us. We can apprehend the weaving and living of the plant world within the fluid, watery element. If we begin to understand this, not by means of abstract concepts, but by means of these images which attune us to inner movement, then we need only look into ourselves to become aware of how all that we can follow in the passage of the seasons through spring, summer, autumn, and winter, in the burgeoning plant world, the overcoming of the cold by warmth, in all that goes on as we pass from autumn to winter, how in all this we can sense something like a miniature image form within us. When we fall asleep, something happens inside us that is very similar to the spring. And as we go on sleeping, it becomes more like the sprouting, blossoming of summer. And as we begin to wake up again, we are heading toward winter. We can see in miniature form what is going on in the outer world in terms of vegetative processes within our etheric bodies. Close quote. The Greek would have said, quote, in your 72 or 76 elements, you can only learn about the human corpse, but this human corpse is imbued with something that can only be grasped in picture form. The kind of pictures that arise when one thinks of vegetative processes as infused with the watery element. This is when we can see how the etheric body within us brings into movement what you have recognized as the element of death, with your 70-odd elements. Thus, unless you raise your awareness to the level of the watery element, you will never be able to understand the human being as a living entity. Close quote. But now, something else comes into the picture. The earth represents what is dead in a human being. The moment a person dies, the corpse is received by the earth and taken over by the 70-odd elements, and from then on, the laws that pertain to the earth, the laws of the earthly element, will take charge. What happens to the laws that belong to the watery element? Quote, "These do not extend to the earth, but their realm is out in the cosmos," close quote. The Greek would go on to say, quote, "And if you wish to know what brings forth this element of coldness and moisture, welling up through spring, summer, autumn, and winter, you will have to look into the nature of the cosmos. First of all to the planets, then to the constellations, and out into the widths of the cosmos. Your earthly element is only relevant to the human being when lying in the grave. The person who is walking about on the earth with his etheric body within him is subject at every moment to the laws of the cosmos. These are the laws that work down into us from the weaving of the planets or the forces of the fixed stars." Close quote. For the Greek of the era I am referring to, the watery element was so significant that he would have said, quote, "In all that constitutes the watery element that surrounds the earth, swathes it in mists, or discharges itself in thunderstorms, wherever the watery element is at work, the cosmos itself works into the earth with all its forces. There is no point in trying to find out about the watery element in the element of earth or in anything that is earth. Instead, we should direct our attention to the cosmos, and then we can raise ourselves up into the nature of the cosmos simply by virtue of the active etheric body within us, which wrests the elements free from the destiny, or shall we say, the chemistry, at work in our bodies between birth and death." Close quote. Moreover, in saying this, we have by no means uncovered the whole truth of the human being. We have only grasped what is infusing our physical body with life, what enables it to grow, what enables digestive processes, and what accompanies us in the way of life forces between birth and death. A third force is at work in us, and the Greek from the period I am referring to would mention this too. A third force makes itself felt within us for the whole time between birth and death in a way that differs from the ordinary life forces. This is the force that is embedded within our rhythmic system, our breathing, our blood circulation, and so on. In everything that involves rhythm and rhythmic activity, you will be able to sense a certain connection between your soul life and the process of breathing, as opposed to merely living. Consider the following phenomenon that we will all be familiar with. You will all at some time have woken up with a peculiar feeling of anxiety. You emerge into consciousness from a feeling of anxiety, and you notice something is not right with your breathing. It is true that the connection between our breathing and our soul life is a mysterious one. But at the most basic level, it can be perceived when our breathing is irregular. There is a connection between our soul life, between all the sensations and feelings surging through us, the feelings of anxiety and fear, of joy and delight, and the rhythm of our breathing and of our blood circulation. This rhythmic system is something altogether different from our simple life processes. Our rhythmic system is connected with our soul. It is, after all, the air we breathe, which activates the whole rhythmic system, and in days of old people spoke of the element of air and of its relationship to the human being. For instance, when, in the mystery schools, they studied the rhythms which govern our inner activity, the same rhythms which belong to the meter used by Homer, the hexameter. If you look at the average rate at which we breathe and our pulse rate, you will observe the following. We draw breath roughly 18 times per minute, and our pulse rate is 4 times that. The rhythm of blood circulation and breathing is 4:1. Now take the hexameter. Long, short, short, long, short, short, long, short, short. There are 3 feet with a caesura as the 4th element. Similarly, there are the 4 heartbeats to each half of the breath. After the caesura, dactyl, dactyl, and once more the caesura. The inner structure of Homeric verse, and indeed of all ancient verse, is drawn from the human rhythmic system. People who took the airy element seriously, the element that unites with us and is released by us, felt that in drawing breath we were drawing something into ourselves that has to do with the forces governing our soul life. And as the Greek began to speak of the airy element, he began to speak of the most beautiful and also the ordinary aspects of human soul life. And he could call to mind that during the course of a 24-hour day, the human being draws breath 25,920 times, and that the sun takes 25,920 years to complete its cycle through the entire vault of the heavens from one spring equinox and back to the same place. He saw the harmony between the rhythm of the world and our own daily rhythm. He pointed out the connection between the soul of the world and the soul of the human being. And he said that what is expressed in the human etheric body is related to the life that passes between birth and death, and which, in its 24-hour cycle, represents in miniature form spring, summer, autumn, and winter. What regulates the watery element that is spread out in the cosmos, cold and moist, and which is subject to the cosmic laws at work in the seasons, the changing weather patterns, and in the movements of the planets, all this is also expressed in the human etheric body. When we come to the rhythmic system, we must turn to the element of air. We must turn to what, in times of old, when people understood it better, gave rise to the soul quality that was expressed in the meter of poetry, because one could sense the connection between the human soul and the soul of the world. When we look at life processes, we are still in the realm of space, albeit by extending our consciousness into cosmic space. When we come out of space, we turn our attention to the rhythmic system and perceive what is sent into space from the realm of time in the form of rhythm. You see, in the rhythmic element, the element of air, the Greek could still perceive something which he described as follows. The human soul has its roots in the cosmic soul, and it is the cosmic soul itself which, living in its rhythms, sends miniature images of them into our lives. Out in the cosmos, the world soul brings it about that the spring rising point moves forward a little every year, and over 25,920 years will have completed the entire circuit of the sun through the zodiac. Similarly, in the 25,920 breaths we draw each day, there is a miniature image of this vast world rhythm. Within 24 hours, we replicate in miniature the 25,920 years it takes the sun to complete its course through the cosmic year. We thus have our roots in the cosmic soul, within which our own souls have their existence. If we now rise to the level of the element of fire, we are concerned not just with our soul life, but with the spirit that penetrates us with our sense of I, capital. And then we are also concerned with what finds its physical expression in our blood. Just as the airy element enables us to perceive the relationship between our own soul and the cosmic soul, so the element of warmth or fire brings to our consciousness the relationship between the human spirit, or I, and the spirit of the cosmos. In earlier times, the human beings were led up into spiritual realms when they heard of the very elements which are considered the product of a childlike consciousness by the clever people of our times. It is now up to us to find our way back to this way of thinking, the difference being that we have to attain it in fully awake consciousness rather than instinctively, as was the case in those earlier times. So, once we penetrate into the watery element, we experience the world itself as a great living being, where we are led out into the cosmos with all its sources of life. We experience the world as something living. When we reach the rhythmical element, we experience the world as ensouled. And once we break through into the element of warmth, we experience the world as essentially spiritual. However, we cannot develop an understanding of the watery element with our abstract concepts. All the concepts that we acquire going through primary and secondary school and on into further education, none of these concepts will enable us to grasp the watery element. This will only reveal itself in picture form. It has to be grasped through imaginations. To do that, we have somehow to transform our abstract way of thinking into a concrete one, into one that is artistic in its approach. Then, of course, the modern philosopher will retort, quote, "There is no such thing as seeing the world in pictures. There is no such thing as an artistic approach to science. I am constructing a theory of knowledge. The laws of nature must be encompassed by logic. Everything you might wish to know about the world must be capable of expression in abstract concepts, in abstract laws." Close quote. This may be a requirement we human beings set ourselves, and such theories of knowledge may be developed. But if nature herself works in an artistic way, then she cannot be encompassed by that kind of epistemology. Her laws have to be grasped in the form of images. It is not up to us to prescribe how nature is to be understood. We should listen to her instead, if we want to know how she wishes to be understood. In the watery element of the plant world, she will only reveal herself through the medium of imagination. In the rhythms of her life, right out into her connection with cosmic rhythms, she can only be understood by means of inspiration, by following the rhythms of life, or by living our way into the rhythms of our breathing. When you have a nightmare, the rhythm of the world comes over you so strongly that you can't bear it. However, if having done certain exercises, you can creep into this airy element yourself and move within its rhythms yourself, then you will find yourself within the world of inspiration. Then you will be outside your body, just as the air itself, which we breathe in and out, is outside your body. Then you can move with the air into and out of your body. Only then you can begin to grasp what the human being truly is, as opposed to what lies in the grave, which is all that modern science can grasp. To do this, one has to let go of abstract concepts, of purely logical images, and acquire the capacity to experience imagination, inspiration, and intuition. In our time, however, abstraction has been developed to a very high degree. It is indeed intelligent. So one can develop the following thought construct. I have perhaps already mentioned it here, but it is important to continue to refer back to such things. Let us suppose that we drive past two places at a given speed. At one place a cannon is fired, and at another place, which one passes through later, a second cannon is also fired, but later. Then we would, of course, hear the sound of the cannon that was fired later, but only after hearing the sound of the first. Now, it is quite possible to think as follows. If you continue to accelerate, you will eventually reach the speed of sound. And if you move at the speed of sound, then when you reach the second place, you will hear the first sound at the same time as the second. Or if you travel faster than the speed of sound, you will hear the second report before the first, because you have left it behind, having travelled faster than the speed of sound. Many such speculative thought constructs are devised today. One thinks, quote, how would two cannons sound to me if I were moving faster than the speed of sound? I'm moving ahead of sound, aren't I? And so I am bound to hear the second sound before the first, which I will have left behind. Close quote. You see, it is quite possible to think something out quite logically, but in a way that does not correspond to reality. For if you were to move at the speed of sound, you would be a sound yourself and give off sound yourself. You would begin to sound. You would blend with the sound itself. It is completely impossible for anyone who thinks realistically to come up with speculation of this kind, but such speculations are rife today. They are referred to as Einstein's theories. Einstein goes to America, the newspapers spread the word that he's achieved enormous results, but he himself said in London that no one in America had understood him. Thus his successes had been achieved among the very people who had not understood him. Perhaps so. In London, however, there was a huge kerfuffle, with people portraying these abstractions coming from a very abstract mode of thought as the greatest and most significant world events. And even the elderly Lord Haldane felt moved to highlight what had actually happened. Fundamentally, all that happened in reality was that one person took the power of abstraction to its pinnacle, the spirit of unreality, the preoccupation with concepts and ideas that are completely removed from any kind of reality and have even less content than the logic that is based on corpses in their graves. For with Einstein's concepts, one can no longer grasp even a corpse, but only the extract of one. There is, however, essentially no countermeasure available to deal with what is spreading throughout humanity. The only remedy is to be found in anthroposophical science, which is seeking a path to concepts based in reality. It is these realistic concepts that will lead us out again into those worlds, for instance, that still appear to us as spatial. There, before us, we have the world as one great living being, the one Goethe spoke of out of a powerful intuition in his prose hymn titled Die Natur. But then, rising up from this world, we come to the world's soul, to cosmic rhythm, to what essentially was once referred to as the harmony of the spheres. We come to cosmic rhythms when we develop the faculties that I tried to describe in my title Occult Science, and can experience imaginations and rhythms of the kind I portrayed there, and from these cosmic rhythms can then be perceived the creative forces of the epochs of Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth, and in future those of Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. These things are the emerging creation of a world developing out of the cosmic rhythms themselves. But look at the way in which these rhythms are spoken of, which flow and come to fruition in sequence. First of all, as human beings, we belong within these rhythms. We do not arise from some whirling about of mineral or animal properties, but from a spiritual, universal wholeness. And where there is a world, we will also find a human being. Then you will discover more. When you reach the world where we are interacting with rhythms, you cannot help speaking of divine spiritual beings. But do you think there is any point when describing the world that is portrayed in a modern chemistry or physics textbook in speaking of angels, archangels, or archai? Of course, it would be very inappropriate when discussing the particular combinations of carbon, the etheric compounds of carbon, alcohol, and so on. If we listed all these formula with their carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and so on, and then added, that belongs to angels and that to archangels, it simply wouldn't do. But once we have reached the realm in which one inevitably sees the Earth's emergence through Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions, when one sees the fabric of life at work in the world, in the rhythms of the world that play into the human soul through their inner rhythms, which one can follow right down into versification, and at the same time can show how this verse is related to the rhythms of blood and breathing, when we reach the realms where Saturn, Sun, and Moon, etc. are depicted, then one is obliged to speak of beings and spiritual hierarchies. We come into a world in which there are real spiritual beings, unlike the world of vague pantheism, to which some people who do not wish to be materialists aspire, and say that the world is full of spirits. Well, yes, the world is filled with spirits. Spiritual quality is to be found everywhere. It is as if someone says, quote, a lion, you say it has a larynx through which it roars, and an esophagus, a windpipe, lungs in the stomach. I can't be bothered with that. I don't wish to talk about that. It is simply filled with lionness through and through, close quote. The philosophical posturing of the pantheists, who like to think of nebulous spirituality dispersed everywhere, is equivalent to someone saying, quote, it is completely filled with lionness, close quote. If we really wish to speak about the spirit, we will have to speak about individual spiritual beings. To do that, we have to know how, once we have progressed from the element of water to the element of air, we can encounter the spiritual beings who are described in the hierarchies. Then once we enter the realm of the fire element, we reach the highest hierarchy, thrones, cherubim, seraphim. And only then to true spiritual forming of worlds, where indeed we humans are unable to distinguish individual details. But before we enter what superficial pantheists would like to describe as the nebulous oneness of all, we pass through the world in which individual, distinct spiritual beings live. Amidst these distinct spiritual beings, we now recognize what also lives in nature that surrounds us, for in doing so we encounter its foundations. We cannot have our being within this nature as we study it with our chemistry and physics. We can only be united with nature when we experience it as also containing the elements of water, air, and fire. The moment we enter the airy element, we find the beings whom we describe as angels, archangels, and archai. That is how we come into the world of concrete spiritual beings. We are then also in a world which we can grasp both physically and morally. Because our vision is obscured today, we do not see, for example, that real morality sounds forth out of the same world as verse. It is true that we will not find the source of morality in the world of the 76 elements, nor will we find there what enlivens us. The world of morality is not even contained in the cosmic and spatial world that is the realm of the element of water. But the moment we enter the rhythmic element, we simultaneously enter the world of morality. People of our time face the task of recognizing the world of morality as a real one, and to recognize that the same material or the same substance which forms our astral body is to be found in moral ideas. The same substance from which our I, capital, is fashioned is to be found in religious ideas, in a religious ideal. We have to find a way of bridging the gap between the contemplation of nature and the contemplation of the spiritual world, in which our moral intuitions have their origin. It was this interplay of the world of perceptions and the world of intuitions that I wanted to point out in my title, Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, in 1893. I wanted to show how concrete moral intuitions are drawn from a world that lies beyond the world of sense perceptions and can be integrated into our world. This is, after all, the great task of our times, not to remain stuck in that aspect of the world which is actually only of any use to us when we're lying in the grave, but rather to rise up into the world which reveals itself to us when we live out our life of soul in the rhythms of the physical world. For it is precisely in the rhythms of the physical world that we learn to know rhythm in its essence. Thus we can come to an understanding of the world rhythms, and these world rhythms can only be understood once we understand the sources, the springs of the moral world. Then we can say to ourselves, yes, I currently do have a natural science, but it is only applicable to the human being as a corpse. Obviously, it must itself originate in the corpse of the world, and derive its being from all that is in decline in the world. It must relate to that aspect of the earth which will one day become its corpse. On the other hand, what we engage with in terms of rhythm, what we might express in verse, for example, in images, in a spiritual form of any kind, so that it is alive in its rhythmic form of expression, and what we grasp intuitively in our moral ideals, in all this, we create something that outlives the death of the earth, in the same way that our individual soul lives beyond the death of our physical body. The earth will perish in accordance with the natural laws that we recognize today. These laws state that the earth will perish, but according to the laws which apply when we approach the spiritual world or act on moral intuitions, on genuine religious intuitions, human souls will evolve, who will leave the earth when it falls away dead, and progress to a new future existence. What we have today, then, is an officially recognized science. It teaches us about what is dead. It teaches us about what will perish with the earth and lie in the great grave of the world. What we need now is spiritual science, which concerns itself in all seriousness with the words of Christ Jesus. Quote, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." Close quote. We need a spiritual science which seeks the true substance of these words spoken by Christ. For these words relate to rhythm, relate to morality, relate to the divine, and to what will pass on to new forms of existence when the earth and the cosmos fall apart and become corpses. We must have an awareness that we need to leave behind a science that only speaks of what is dead, and move on to a science which raises itself up to what is alive, and thus to what belongs to the soul and the spirit. A science of the mysteries did in fact still exist until the year 333 AD, roughly up to the first half of the 4th century AD. It was actually not until the 6th century that the last of the Greek sages were fully driven away. Now, what were the intentions of this mystery science? This mystery science wanted to help humanity pass the great danger of physical life. In those days, it was still relatively easy to help people avoid the great danger of physical life because people still retained some of the cohesive power of group souls. This relationship to their group souls was still very strong until the 4th century AD. This changed, however, when the great migrations started and the tendency to relate to group souls was broken up by the particular element that came from the Germanic peoples. The leaders of these mysteries, however, only drew certain individuals toward them whom they regarded as having special capacities. They then helped develop them within the mysteries to particular levels of attainment. In doing so, however, they not only did something for the individual involved, but also, given the group spirits still at work there, at the same time did something for all the people in that area. Going back to ancient Egyptian times, there were only a few initiates, but they were also the intellectual leaders in all fields, leaders of the entire Egyptian people. And because the group soul was still active, their influence extended to the others who were not initiated. Thus, at that time, there was no need for more than a few initiates. What was the motive for this initiation? The intention was nothing less than to enable the people to avert the danger of their souls becoming mortal. They had a different view of immortality in Egypt to the one that prevails today. Today we tend to think of immortality as something that belongs to us as a matter of course, something we cannot lose. In the Mysteries of Samothrace, however, the teaching was this. There are four kibiri, and three of these always kill the fourth. What they meant was that the human being has a physical body, an etheric, an astral, and an I, capital. First the physical body succumbed to death, as a physical corpse. Then the etheric body dispersed into the cosmos. The astral body also dissolved, in a certain way, as I have shown in my title, Theosophy. If the I does not sustain its self-consciousness, by engaging with the spirit, the other three will also kill the fourth, and drag it down into mortality. The task of the mysteries was to save human beings from losing their immortality. People did not think that one could attain immortality by prayer. They did not imagine that one could have a purely passive relationship to immortality. But they understood that those who were initiates would be able, by the particular transformation of their soul being, as a result of an inner awakening, by the awakening of their I, to avert the danger of not being able to grasp their own spirituality, and thus of having to go the way of their physical body. Moreover, since some initiates had this power of retaining thinking beyond the physical body, they could pass it on to the others by virtue of the group soul spirit. Today, this group soul quality is no more, a condition that has been in gradual preparation since the first third of the 15th century. Today we are called on to acquire freedom as individuals. Today we have essentially reached the point where we face the opposite danger. Whilst people were in danger of not being able to grasp their own spirituality until the 4th century AD, so that one had to bring about an inner awakening into this spiritual experience, today's human being is now capable of thought by virtue of the particular way in which his physical body has developed, the way matter has evolved, and we live extremely strongly in our thinking. Those who believe they are living in reality are precisely those who live in their thoughts. People today are terribly given to abstractions. They instantly fall for anything that is abstract, because they have an affinity for abstractions. Moreover, these are not simply wrongly understood when it is said that they are dependent on our brains. They are indeed dependent on our brains, because our brains imitate the processes that we have gone through in the spiritual world before our birth or conception. Our brains mimic what our souls experienced before they descended. Because this thinking, which has now been developed to a particular state of perfection, is purely brain-bound, materialism is correct. It has to be continually emphasized that materialism is quite right in regard to the thinking that applies today, for it is just an imitation of true living thinking. And that is why we must attain the capacity to grasp freedom in our thinking, and thus to save ourselves. In practice, this means not simply letting our brains think, but rather to take hold of our thinking in such a way that we become aware that we are free beings. That is why I have attached such importance to pure thinking, to free thinking, which can simultaneously apprehend itself as will, so that we can think and at the same time will, so that thinking and willing are substantially one activity which can apprehend itself in pure freedom, as I have set out in my title, Philosophy of Spiritual Activity. This is intended to show people you are only free when you can grasp what is immortal within you, with which you can rescue yourself, preserve yourself from the death of the four kibiri. Admittedly, we have now reached a point where we are about to step onto thin ice, which people today are reluctant to approach, because we would much rather that our immortality were guaranteed in some way by some outer agency, so that we are not obliged to contribute in any way to awakening in ourselves what otherwise would fall asleep, and which would then follow the human body as it goes through death. As people of our time increasingly make our thinking resemble the processes going on in our brain, we not only risk no longer understanding anything about immortality, but we run the risk of losing immortality altogether. This is indeed the primary aim of Ahriman, to destroy our individuality, no longer allowing anyone to be individual, but instead to take the forces we have, our power of thinking, into the forces of the earth, so that when one day the earth is one great corpse, it will be woven through with all the powers that human beings have embodied in it by means of our logic. Thus, we would have one great earth spider, in which 70-odd elements would exist in a completely pulverized form. Within that, like gigantic spiders tangling each other up, would be woven our purely abstract thinking. That is the ideal toward which Ahriman is striving, to destroy the individuality of human beings in order, with the power of human thinking, to transform the earth into a web of gigantic thought spiders, but real spiders. That is the Ahrimanic goal from which we must escape, by really imbuing ourselves with the spirit word, quote, "not I, but the Christ in me," close quote. This will enable the true I to come alive within us, the immortal I, which can understand the words, quote, "heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away," close quote. That wisdom cannot pass away, the wisdom that is reality, that embraces reality within it, and by means of which, when the earth is a corpse, the whole essence of the human being can reproduce itself in a new form of existence. The new Jerusalem spoken of in the Apocalypse refers to such a form of existence. The greatest hindrance to this is, of course, every kind of Einstein-like thinking, everything which is spreading through the world as the great and terrible addiction to abstraction, which is increasingly capable of developing forces of decline. Humanity can only be helped by resorting to powers of regeneration, real powers within body, soul, and spirit. That is what I wanted to say to you this evening, the end of Lecture 2.